Good evening, and welcome to Carousel. Each Sunday evening at this time, WDRT offers original programming that highlights the lively arts. Rotating on a weekly basis, we present a variety of live music, radio theater, spoken word, original fiction, poetry, and performance art. Each week's selection is presented by talented local volunteers who offer you a unique experience with the artistic talent found here in the Driftless. Now sit back and enjoy this week's performance. Welcome to Carousel on WDRT.
The ghoulish gang of players. We are all assembled here. We are a troop of seven, all entombed together in this studio vault, here to read you some spooky tales as we set our sights on Halloween, or as the Irish call it, Samhain, marking the end of the harvest season and the beginning of the darker half of the year. This is the time when the doorways to the other world are opened and the souls of the dead are able to cross through the thin veil into the world of the living. Offerings of food and drink are left for the spirits in order to assure that the livestock live through the winter. It is a time of divinations, bonfires, and mischief. The trick-or-treat of going house to house to gather food for the autumnal festival was common in the 16th century Scotland, and if one did not contribute, there was certainly a trick played on them in the form of misfortune. And we are fortunate to have seven witchy voices with us tonight. Hey, we've got Kate Kozel, Bonnie Weidman, Celie Wolf, Carl Schlecht, David Oldenburg, Kat Tigerman, and myself, your host, Kay O'Brien. And we will start off with Celtic tales of the Banshee, the Pooka, and three short stories from W.B. Yeats. So get as comfortable as you can in your coffin as we delve into an All Hallowed Eve's hour. Oh!
A banshee is known in Ireland as a female spirit who wails outside the home to warn of imminent death of a family member. Often heard before she is seen, her wailing is so high-pitched that nobody would dare willingly attempt this terrifying spirit. In Ireland, the banshee does not cause or bring death. The ghost warns loved ones that death is near, giving the family a chance to prepare. Some myths say that she acts as an escort to ensure that their loved one passes safely to the other side. According to legend, the banshee can also take many forms. However, in Ireland, she's most commonly seen as either a beautiful young woman with long, flowing, silver, white, or sometimes red hair, or as an old woman in rags and dirty grey hair, long fingernails, and sharp-pointed, rotten teeth. Both descriptions also give the banshee eyes, which are noticeably red from crying so much. The banshee is famous for her long, melancholy keening, which is an Irish word that is used to describe the lament that women used to do over the body of a deceased person to ward off evil spirits. Originally, it was said that the banshee only keened for the families O'Grady, O'Neill, O'Brien, O'Connor, and Kavanagh. However, there are stories from various other families that she particularly favourites those with an O or a Mick in a surname, such as O'Brien or McNeil, for example. I remember being told as a young child of an uncle who was walking home on a cold and blustery night. He was probably three sheets to the wind after partaking of a snifter to keep the cold out. On arriving home, he told my grandmother that he had tried to comfort an old woman he had met along the way. Describing her, he said, the old woman was dressed in a black with a veil on her face, and she was crying and a-wailing outside the house. Every time he went over, she moved away, but all the while kept on pointing at the house. My grandmother, with all her knowledge of the old Irish legends, knew straight away what this old lady represented, and hurried my uncle to bed, reassuring him that she herself would have a look for the old woman. Needless to say, she didn't dare do such a thing. Then, sure enough, only 3 days after this strange encounter, my grandmother's brother died peacefully in his sleep. As children, we used to plague my uncle to recount the story of the night he tried to invite the banshee in for tea.
A long time ago, in County Galway, on the west coast of Ireland, there lived a boy who played the pipes. To be precise, He could play exactly one tune on the pipes, which was Black Rogue. He played it often enough and earned good money for his single song. One night, he had been performing at a gentleman's party and was returning home in jolly spirits. As he crossed an old stone bridge, slightly swaying from side to side and piping his one and only tune, the pooka came up behind him. Now, in case you don't know, the pooka is a creature that lives in the countryside of Ireland. It can easily shift its shape. Sometimes the pooka might look like a horse or a goat or a goblin. In this case, it walked on two legs and had horns on its head. He gave the piper boy such a hard shove in the back that he fell right over, landed on his pipes, and squeezed all the air out of the bag so it made a sound like a cat. The boy had fighting spirit in him. He was soon back on his feet, and he grabbed the fairy creature by the horns. The pooka, however, had the strength of the supernatural, and he easily picked the lad up and placed him on the side of the bridge.
Any more trouble and you and your bagpipes will be swimming in the river. Now stand up and play Shan Vanach for me.
I would gladly, but I don't know the notes.
Put your wind in your pipes and I'll put the notes in your head.
The boy blew with all his might and played the jig so that he wondered at his own skill.
Musha, you're a fine music teacher. How come you're so keen to teach me new tunes?
Tonight there's a feast in the House of the Banshees, and you shall play for them.
Now the pooka transformed himself into a horse, and as the boy had little choice, he climbed onto its back. The pooka dashed over hills and through bogs. Finally, they clattered down a road to the gates of a grand country house. The pooka knocked three times on the door with his hoof, and it opened by itself. They clip-clopped through into a grand dining room. Here, the raucous cackling, shrieking, and chattering of 100 old women filled the air to the rafters. The banshees were in the midst of a magnificent feast. One of them stood up and raised a goblet of wine to the new arrivals.
Welcome, pooka. Who have you brought tonight to us riding on your back?
The finest piper in Ireland.
Then the piper boy stood on a chair, blew into his pipes, and played jigs and reels, waltzes and polkas. The old ladies all took to the floor and danced in a frenzy until the first morning light kissed the window panes.
Time to pay the piper for his tunes.
And each of the ladies threw a gold coin into the musician's cap. The boy's eyes boggled.
By the tooth of St. Patrick, I'm as rich as a lord.
Before he left, there was one more surprise in store for him. A goose came into the dining hall and started to clear up the tables.
I know that goose. I took her from Father Mulligan's garden last Christmas. I swear, my mother, my sister, and I ate her all, except for one wing that we gave to Mary next door, and she told the priest that I was the one that had stolen his bird.
Fortunately, neither the pooka nor the banshees held a poor opinion of a lad who stole birds for his mother's table. The boy mounted the pooka once again, and they rushed back to the bridge where they had met. From there, he returned home on foot.
Mother!
he called out as he came through the door.
I've just come from the house of the banshees. The pooka carried me there on his back and returned me safely to the stone bridge just 10 minutes ago.
Musha, you've been at the whiskey.
I've not had a drop,
insisted the boy, and he took out his purse and emptied the gold coins onto the table.
There, see the proof? I'm as rich as a lord.
Deary me, you've had more than a drop.
For they were not gold coins that spilled out of the boy's purse, but acorns.
Fairy magic. But you'll believe my story when you hear my skill at the pipes.
He blew into his pipes. At first he made a sound like all the geese in Ireland were screeching at one time. He woke the neighbors who came first to complain and then to mock him. But gradually the boy's pipes came back into tune and he started to play marvelous music. Later that day, he went to Father Mulligan's house and told him the story.
You're nothing but a thief and a liar.
But when he heard the boy play the pipes so wondrously well, even the priest wondered if there was some truth in the tale. And so long as he lived, the boy was the finest piper in all of Ireland.
November is the month of pooka. November is the month of pooka. Pooka is a changeling and can take an animal's human form, like a horse, donkey, cat, dog, bull, young man.
Or even a voluptuous young woman.
The pooka is usually jet black with fiery golden or red eyes, known for its cunning and wile as well as lies and deception. Pooka's archetype is a trickster.
Pooka is also a fertility spirit, since it has the power to create or destroy. It is a gifted prophesier, as it has the ability of human speech. The boogeyman is derived from pooka, and also Easter Bunny, which is a pagan origin, a fairy-like creature that brings chocolate eggs and sweets to children at Easter, has its roots in the fertility spirit theme of pooka.
In the film Harvey, the giant white bunny was inspired by pooka.
In William Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck is a mischievous and quick-witted sprite responsible for setting many of the play's events in motion through his magic.
Often appearing as a horse, Pooka sometimes gallops across the countryside, knocking down fences and gates and destroying crops. In this form, Pooka likes to take a rider, usually a drunkard, on a wild ride all night and shake him off in the gray of the morning. This person, already heavily inebriated, is also under the spell of the pooka and has no recollection of what happened. This often accounts for why some people, who having gotten very drunk, report that they have no idea what happened the previous night.
The only man to ever successfully ride a pooka was the High King of Ireland and the founder of the O'Brien dynasty, Brian Boru. Brian managed to control the magic of the creature by using a special bridle that has used the three hairs of the pooka's tail. Brian's physical prowess meant that he was able to stay on its back until an exhausted pooka surrendered to Brian. The king forced it to agree to two promises. First, it no longer tormented Christian people and ruined their property.
And second, that it would never again attack an Irishman, except those who were drunk or were abroad with evil intent. Although Pooka agreed, it appears to have forgotten its promises over the years. Past history records many sightings of Pooka all over the world, but the most famous story is an animal spirit that gave its name to Pukaloka, Hole of the Pooka, at the boundary of the River Liffey between the counties of Kildare and Wicklow. Presently, this is the site of a hydroelectric power station where the river flows through a narrow gorge before plunging 150 feet, or 46 meters, in three stages. Under the second drop, there is a pool, and this is called the Hole of Pooka.
In November 1813, a hunt known as Killing Kuldar set out. Having indulged in traditional stirrup cup at Tipper Crossroads, the hunt failed to raise a fox until it was approaching Tipper Kevin, north of Ballymore Eustace, County Kuldar. Here, a large fox appeared and led a course towards the Liffey. Simultaneously, an unmounted black horse appeared that did not belong to any of the riders. It was Pooka. The terrain was difficult, and the fox ran fast, so that near the Liffey, only one of the members of the hunt, a man named Grennan, and a horse, who was really Pooka, remained with the pack. The gorge was in full spate, but hounds were gaining on their quarry and started to pick their way across the rocks. Seeing danger, Grennan attempted to recall the hounds, but Pooka, ahead of them, was tempting them onwards. The fox headed for a ledge on a narrow part of the gorge. Then, seeing Pooka's red eyes spitting fire, fox jumped. It missed the ledge, falling into turbulent waters below. The Pooka easily leaped across the gorge, disappearing into the woodlands, but the pack of hounds hard were on the scent of the fox and went headlong into the pool. Looking down, Grennan saw the fox and hounds trying desperately to swim to safety through swirling swell. The other hounds, dashed against the rocks, were yelping in pain and dying. He wept as most of the pack went under. Suddenly, his sorrow gave way to terror. He heard a diabolical neighing like an animal laughing from the woods opposite. Grennan knew then it was Pooka.
On Wednesday, 1st November 2006, about 7:30 p.m., Dennis O'Rourke, a businessman and investor, originally from Cork City but then living in Malahide County, Dublin, believes he met Pooka. A strange and well-dressed man was outside the front gate of Dennis's house. The man struck up a conversation with Dennis, claiming he had known him for years. He went on to tell Dennis about his family, true facts he could not have known going back three generations, and how over the years they had lost and gained money. This man, who did not give a name, also said that family finances were based on more than just heritage. They were also subject to the greater economy of the nation. Over the next couple of years, O'Rourke witnessed not merely fiscal fall of the country, but his own financial ruin, including his businesses, his family home, and two other houses he had invested in. Harding alleges that there had been several similar reports and possibly many more from others who are too embarrassed to reveal them. The problem, Harding claims, is that many people are not aware that anything unusual has happened until after Pooka has left. Not only that, but when disaster does happen, Pooka, like T.S. Eliot's elusive cat McCavity, is not there.
There was a doubter in Donegal, and he would not hear of ghosts or sheogs. And there was a house in Donegal that had been haunted as long as man could remember. And this is the story of how the house got the better of the man. The man came into the house and lighted a fire in the room under the haunted one and took off his boots and set them on the hearth and stretched out his feet and warmed himself. For a time, he prospered in his unbelief, but a little while after, the night had fallen and everything had got very dark. One of his boots began to move. It got up off the floor and gave a kind of slow jump towards the door. And then the other boot did the same. And after that, the first boot jumped again. And thereupon, it struck the man that an invisible being had got into his boots and was now going away in them. When the boots reached the door, they went upstairs slowly. And then the man heard them go tramp, tramp, round the haunted room over his head. A few minutes passed, and he could hear them upon the stairs. After that, in the passage outside, and then one of them came in the door, and the other gave a jump past it and came in too. They jumped along toward him, and then one got up and hit him, and after that, the other hit him, and then again, the first hit him, and so on, until they drove him out of the room. And finally out of the house. In this way, he was kicked out of his own boots, and Donegal was avenged upon its doubter. It is not recorded whether the invisible being was a ghost or one of the shees. But the fantastic nature of the vengeance is like the work of the shees, who live in the heart of fantasy.
And we leave the realm of the Celtic Isles and head for a story from India. Kali, the Hindu goddess associated with time, change, creation, power, death, and destruction. She is black with red eyes and wild hair like the banshee. She destroys evil to defend the innocent and is worshipped as a divine protector.
According to Hindu tradition, we are living in the earth-shattering age known as the Kali Yuga. How has this come about? After ruling earth for thousands of years, the old gods were worried. They had stirred up unbridled rage and created vast armies which were eager to annihilate their opponents. The old gods feared that they could not stop the destructive rage that would destroy the earth. At the brink of total disaster, their war lust merged and became a supernova, throwing out flames in all directions. A unique light appeared out of the flames and became a female form. The goddess Kali arose to step between the masculine forces of annihilation.
We, the primordial gods, pray to the Mother Earth goddess. May Kali Ma emerge from Mother Earth's brow.
I am here now. I am one, and I am many. I am the nurturing mother. I am the unity of the transcendental. I am the trickster. I am the manifestation of the nonviolent female form. I am the destroyer of demons. I assume a form which frightens the forces of egocentric masculinity. I am the annihilator of the masculine will to power. I transcend the opposite.
A tremendous power is poised, ready for the grim battle to wipe out demonic forces. The demons whose exaggerated ego sense is destroying the balance of the universe, whose sole purpose is to dominate and control. It is a war between knowledge and ignorance, truth and falsehood, the oppressor and the oppressed. As the world shook and the seas trembled, Goddess Kali engaged the great demon Mahasura and his hosts in fierce battle. She created female battalions from the sighs she breathed during the fighting. When the battle was over, Kali had destroyed the demon's army, who embodied disruptive aggression. Enraged by Kali's victory, Mahasura took on a buffalo form to overcome the goddess.
I, Kali, drink from the wine cup charged with spiritual force. I strike off the demon head from the buffalo body of Mahasura.
We gods praise you, Kali Ma. We joyfully worship you with flowers, incense, and fragrant lotions. Thou, Kali, daughter of Mother Earth, you overspread the universe with thy power. The power of all divine beings is drawn into thy form. Thou art the great mother, worshipped by all divine beings and sages. We bow ourselves in devotion to thee. Bless us with all that is good for us.
But her victory was not the end of the struggle. Kali went to the mountaintop. Another powerful demon, Thumba, had also deprived the gods of their proper divine functions, and once more the gods prayed to the goddess. The powerful demon, Thumba, came upon the goddess and tried to disarm her with flattery.
You are so beautiful. Come and be my wife. Then wealth beyond compare will be yours.
Thumba is indeed wealthy and powerful. But how shall what I have promised be made false? Hear the promise I have made to myself in my foolishness. He who conquers me in battle, who removes my pride, who is my match for strength here in this world, he shall be my husband. Let Thumba vanquish me here, and may he soon claim my hand in marriage.
If you will not come to me now with pleasure, I shall take you by force, and I shall drag you by your hair in distress.
If you will take me by force, what can I do?
The demon chief's warriors rushed forward. Kali reduced them all to ashes with a mere sound, a supersonic hum, while Kali's spirited and angry tiger destroyed the demon's army. Then Thumba himself went against Kali with an even larger force, but she threw holy water on them and they fled. But the mighty demon Thumba remained, trying to annihilate female archetypal power. Kali again and again drank seed blood from her womb. Her drink was far more powerful than Sumba's phallic destructiveness.
The many forms that I have projected of my own powers are now withdrawn into myself. There I stand alone. I shall fight steadfastly from this high mountaintop. Thumba sprang up and flew high into the sky. I pierced his heart with my dart. I watch as you fall, Thumba. I have vanquished you.
Salutations, great Kali. Thine is the power of creation, preservation, and dissolution. Thou art eternal. Thou art the ground of being. Thou art the energies of nature, queen and protector of the universe.
The world was at peace again. The skies cleared. The rivers kept their course. There was sweet singing and dancing. The winds blew softly and the sun shone brilliantly. Sacred fires burned steadily. Then Kali disappeared from the very spot where she sat and where all the gods were gazing. They absorbed the deepest truths of her disappearance, that feminine action in the cosmic drama is without retentive, ego-seeking ambition. Kalima disappeared, returning to her pure, enlightened, illusory body, and there was peace on Mother Earth.
You are listening to WDRT Community Radio, and we are the Players, bringing you the spooks of the season. Also getting their ghostly spirits on are our friends in La Crosse at the Pump House. Gray Area Productions is opening The Thin Place by Lucas Knapp. It's an occult play about the power of connecting to the other side. It opens this coming Friday and plays the last two weekends of the month. So check out the Pump House. Our friends Sarah Tedeschi and Evan Blattner are a part of the cast, so plan to attend and support the arts. And here's a quick little clip of a scene from The Thin Place, as soon as I can find it, because I just clicked it off, and see?
Linda was a psychic, a real professional psychic. I first met her at something called a sitting, which is something that's sort of like what I did alone in my room as a kid, but it's done by someone who really knows what they're doing. And it takes place at a house, like someone's nice house, And there's a bunch of people there gathered together in the living room. And there's candles and there's incense burning. And Linda walks into the room and it begins. Now let's get one thing straight. There is no death. When you die, you merely pass on to something else. What I do is like a radio antenna. I tune my dial and then all these voices start coming at me. Picture 20 or so people all trying to use the same telephone at once, and I'm the telephone. You get very confusing for me. So I do need your help. If I say a name and you think it's someone calling for you, you have to speak up and let me know, otherwise I move on. Your granddad or your mom or whoever it is sad no one picked up the phone. And I look like an idiot. Linda spoke to so many spirits that evening. She would hear a name, say it, and every time someone would raise their hand and say, that's my brother, or that's my wife, or there was even a child who died in a car accident. She knew the color of the car and where it happened. I'm hearing a name. Please speak up, spirit. I think it's Helen. Is that it? Helen? Yeah? Who knows Helen?
I do.
You know Helen.
Mm-hmm.
Someone close to you, passed on. She's...
Yes.
Uh-huh. What's your name, dear?
Hilda.
Helen? I've got Hilda here.
And that was a little snapshot of The Thin Place being put on by Gray Area Productions at the Pump House in La Crosse this coming weekend and the weekend following. And also this weekend, so much is happening. Friday at 7 p.m. at the Commons, John Heimbuch, the artistic director of Walking Shadow Theater in Minneapolis, will bring his one-man show, Beowulf, the classic Old English poem about a warrior king who defeats powerful monsters. Be sure to catch this epic hero poem at the Commons, 7 p.m. this Friday. And we also have a sampling of John performing an excerpt.
Outside, in the night, began to glide the shadow stalker Grendel from the marsh. Beneath the foggy hills, beside the bog, and trackless over misty turf he moved, intending to ensnare some humankind, and joyless he arrived at our place. He tore the door down with a single touch and stepped into the hall, the raging fiend aroused, and from his eyes, the monster's eyes, a hellish, ugly light sliced up the air. As he surveyed the hall, a troop of many warriors he found in sleep upon their pallets, splayed, dreaming. Grendel's gut growled, his heart laughed. Here was hope of feasting full. He did intend to tear the life from every single body there. The first he grabbed, a handsome warrior, devoured huge morsels of the man alive, into his muscles bit, tore him apart, drank down the gushing and delicious blood, and soon the whole corpse had consumed indeed. Down to the feet and hands. Along he moved to seize another body. Beowulf lay still, and Grendel grabbed the hero hard, who did perceive his hostile plan at once, sat up in fierce response, and pitted weight into the monster's arm by holding thus, and Grendel gasped. In that time instant there, each fighter knew that nowhere on the earth existed one whose hands were harder. Fear floods into mind and spirit, forcing flesh to tremble in example of the rage. But Beowulf, his boast recalling, stood, and holding fast, those fingers cracked. And how the fiendish devil tried to flee. He pulled and tried to twist the hero's grip, which gained for every second inches on his arm. And then our place resounded with the din, the tumbling over of tables here, of benches there, through piles of weaponry, across the floor in raging clutches fought, and stranger noises rose. The horrid sound of Grendel's screaming throat exploded now, defeat song wailing painfully. Hell's slave, caught in the arms of he who of all men upon the earth was strongest, fiercest. Now, by this time, all the other warriors had leapt out of their bed, and ancient swords were drawn. They hacked and hewed and hemmed from every side the furious monster, sought his soul. No use. the Grendel had bewitched their weapons. Yes, with black and hellish arts, the devil charmed their sword points dull, the edges blunt, yet as of this very hour, his time was done, and death drew fearful near. Down would he go into the hands of fiends much worse than he. Our hero's grip did crush the monster so. Beowulf twisted at the devil's arm, pain flashed, and Grendel howled again as bone from sinew split and sprang apart, the muscle ripped away, the joint lock crunched beneath our hero's hearty hands, which thirsted gore. But the Grendel escaped.
That was
to find a joyless death.
Oh my. Let's give that man applause. That was so fun. And you can see that whole show. That is Beowulf. And that will be this Friday at 7 p.m. And now our spooky team of ghouls is ready to bring you Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of the Red Death, first published in 1842. It is the story of Prince Prospero's attempt to avoid a deadly plague.
The Red Death had long devastated the country.
No pestilence had ever been so fatal
or so hideous.
Blood was its avatar and its seal.
The redness.
And the horror of the blood.
There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness.
And profuse bleeding at the pores.
With disillusion.
The scarlet stains upon the body, and especially upon the face of the victim.
Were the ban which shut him out from the aid.
And from the sympathy of his fellow men.
And the whole seizure,
progress,
and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour.
But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court, and with these retired to the deep seclusion of one of the castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massive hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress or egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within.
The abbey was amply provisioned.
With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself.
In the meantime, it was folly to grieve.
Or to think.
The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure.
There were buffoons.
There were improvisators.
There were ballet dancers.
There were musicians.
There was beauty.
There was wine.
And these, all these, and security were within.
Without was the Red Death.
It was toward the close of the fifth or sixth month of this seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence.
It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade. But first let me tell you of the rooms in which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite. In many palaces, however, such suites form a long and straight vista, where the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here, the case was very different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bizarre. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn, a novel effect to the right and left. In the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor, which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opened. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple, and its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the seven apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum. Amid the profusion of golden ornaments that lay scattered to and fro or descended from the roof, there was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridors that followed the suite, there stood opposite to each window a heavy tripod bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illuminated the room, and thus were produced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within its precincts at all.
It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. And when the minute hand made the circuit of the face, and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that at each lapse of an hour the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause momentarily in their performance to hearken the sound.
And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions.
And there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay community.
And while the chimes of the clock yet rang,
it was observed that the giddiest grew pale,
and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation.
But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly.
The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them so similar an emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes,
which embrace 3,600 seconds of the time that flies,
there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then, with the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before.
But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The taste of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decor of mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster.
There were some who would have thought him mad.
His followers felt that he was not.
It was necessary to hear and see and touch him
to be sure that he was not.
He had directed in great part the movable embellishments of the seven chambers upon occasion of this great fête, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders.
Be sure they were grotesque.
There was much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies, such as the madman fashions. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust.
To and fro in the seven chambers there stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams. And these, the dreams, writhed in and about, taking hue from the rooms and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echo of their steps.
And anon, there strikes the ebony clock, which stands in the hall of the velvet. And then, for a moment, all is still and all is silent, save the voice of the clock. The dreams are stiff frozen as they stand, but the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but an instant, and a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But to the chamber which lies most westwardly of the seven, there are now none of the maskers who venture, for the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery appalls. And to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony a muffled peal more solemnly emphatic than any which reaches their ears who indulge the more remote gaieties of the other apartments.
But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life. And the revel went whirlingly on until at length there commenced the sounding of midnight upon the clock.
And then the music ceased, as I have told, and the evolution of the waltzers were quieted.
But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock. And thus it happened, perhaps, that more of thought crept with more of time into the meditations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure, which had arrested the attention of no single individual before.
And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there arose at length from the whole community a buzz.
Or murmur.
Expressive of disapprobation and surprise.
And then finally, of terror.
Of horror.
And of disgust.
In an assembly of phantasms such as I have painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensations. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited. But the figure in question had out-heroded Herod and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum.
There are chords in the hearts of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion.
Even with the utterly lost, to whom life and death are equally jests, there are matters of which no jest can be made. The whole company, indeed, seemed now deeply to feel that in the costume and bearing of the stranger neither wit nor propriety existed.
The figure was tall and gaunt, and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the clothes The closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat.
And yet, all this might have been endured, if not approved, by the mad revelers around.
But the mummer has gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death.
His vestiture was dabbled in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror.
When the eyes of Prince Prospero fell upon this spectral image, he was seen to be convulsed. In the first moment, with a strong shudder, either of terror or distaste.
But in the next, his brow was reddened with rage.
Who dares? Who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements.
It was in the eastern or blue chamber in which stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand.
It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in the direction of the intruder, who, at the moment, was also near at hand.
And now, with deliberately and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker.
But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth to seize him.
So that, unimpeded, he passed within a yard of the prince's person.
And while the vast assembly, as if one impulse, shrank from the centers of the room to the wall,
he made his way uninterruptedly.
But with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first.
Through the blue chamber to the purple.
Through the purple to the green.
From the green to the orange.
Through this again to the white.
And even thence to the violet.
Ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him.
It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all.
He bore aloft a drawn dagger, and had approached in rapid impetuosity to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure. When the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer.
There was a sharp cry.
Ah!
And the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet.
Upon which, instantly afterward, fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero.
Then, summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer,
whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadows of the ebony clock,
gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave, cerement, and corpse-like mask which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form.
And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall, and the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay.
And the flames of the tripods expired.
And darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all.
You have just heard the Poltergeist Players reading stories for the coming darkness. This hour is available on the Players Podcast page on the WDRT website, so please pass these along in the next 2 weeks to anyone who missed this Halloween pleasure. Our readers have been Bonnie Weidman, Celie Wolf, Kate Kozel, Carl Schleck, David Oldenburg, Kat Tigerman, and I'm your host, Kay O'Brien. Tune in next month, the third Sunday of every month, and